Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Dr. James Dolezal, welcome back to Think for Christ.
Anthony, it's good to be back on with you.
James, I come from a charismatic and Pentecostal background. My dad pastored a charismatic church, which later also embraced Pentecostalism. In these Protestant expressions of Christianity, a premium is placed on the emotions, on the affections, in one's devotion to God. And not surprisingly, for me, the most difficult part of classical theism to swallow was this notion of divine impassibility, which, among other things, denies emotional states in God. Over time, however, as I began to understand what was at stake in this doctrine, I embraced it as a fundamental and non-negotiable piece of theology proper. But like me, most Christians who are initially exposed to the idea that God is not subject to emotional states and affections struggle with it. So I'd like to start us off by getting clear on exactly what we mean when we say that God is impassible, and why it's so critical for us to uphold this doctrine. So James, if you would, please define this doctrine for us, and then motivate it for us. What do we mean when we say that God is impassible, and why is it so important that we defend this view of the divine nature?
I think first we should acknowledge why this view sounds so startling to modern Christians. And it's understandable why it would. When we read Holy Scripture, we read of God's care and concern for his own. We read of his wrath against the wicked. We read in Genesis 6 of grief in his heart and in various passages of his bowels being turned over within him. And I think it's not going to help the classical theist view to somehow skirt the fact that Scripture presents God to us in a very passibilist presentation. That is to say, he appears to be going through a series of emotional experiences triggered in him by often our actions. And we have to have a place to understand the truth value of all of those statements and those passibilist presentations of God in Scripture. I would say, as an interpretive strategy, not to get too far ahead of myself, that we should put all of the passion language in the Bible in the same place that we put all of the physiological function language in the Bible. So when we talk about God's bowels or God's eyelids or his eyes or his right arm as opposed to his left arm, I suppose. When we talk about his legs or his hair or his nostrils and the smelling of aromas wafting into them, typically, we tend to take those as non-literal statements, anthropomorphisms, using human language and human functions and operations to say something true about God. So when we talk about, for instance, his bowels being turned over within him, what we really mean is that like one who is made sick to his stomach by observing some horrendous evil, and therefore detests horrendous evil and is opposed to it, God detests horrendous evil and is opposed to it. But the way the text will narrate that for us is by using the modality by which we ourselves come to detest evil, and it will ascribe it to God. Not that we are to take the modality literally, but what we are to take away from it is, like one who is repulsed by evil, God opposes it with the fullness of his being. So I guess what I would say is I would take all the passibilist language of Scripture and put it in the same interpretive category as I put all the materialist language of Scripture for God. If God is without a body, if he's pure spirit, if he doesn't have physiological functions and an upset tummy, but yet nevertheless, all those texts still have truth value and reveal something true about God's judgment of and assessment of the world, then I would say we could make that we could draw the same truth value from statements about God being grieved in his heart, or changing his mind, as we read in some passages, or relenting, or repenting, as the old King James would have put it. So that's an interpretive strategy, but I think we need to be sympathetic at the outset to those who read their Bible in, I would call, a hyper-literalist fashion, and that they sincerely are desirous to be true and faithful to the text of Scripture. And that's a good instinct. Nevertheless, an interpretive strategy for why that might be problematic needs to be set out. So let's come into what you asked, the definition or the meaning of this doctrine. Why would anyone say that God is without passions? And historically, many Protestants following Catholics and father, medieval Catholics and fathers who went before them said exactly that. The 39 Articles of Religion begins that the Lord our God is without body parts or passions. That's Article 1, probably penned by Thomas Cranmer in the 1550s. Then picked up in the next century by the Presbyterians in the Westminster Confession, the Congregationalists in the Savoy Confession, the particular Baptists in their Second London Confession, but also the General Baptists in their Orthodox Creed. So this was a doctrine that was held by Calvinists, by Arminians, by Amarildians, by Roman Catholics, by Lutherans, every variation of Protestantism. It was widespread that God was without passions. But why say this? There are a couple reasons why. Some of it is just understanding what we mean by it. What we don't mean is that God doesn't care. And I don't know, Anthony, when you talk to people about this doctrine, is that not sort of the first response? Are you saying God doesn't care? If I tell my students,
for sure,
God's not passionate about you or about anything, they translate that into indifference and doesn't care about.
Doesn't love you. Yeah.
Doesn't love you, and also doesn't oppose the wicked. Kind of a morally numb somehow.
Yeah.
But that's what that must mean. And if you're working from an anthropocentric viewpoint in which caring about requires that you undergo experiences to stir up your care, then a lack of passions or emotions could very well indicate a kind of moral numbness. And yet this is where we need to make a distinction between the creature and the creator, that the creator's knowledge of and care for the creature is not something that is stirred up in him, or more precisely actualized in him, by the creature itself. And the reason is not because God doesn't care about the creature, but because he cares so perfectly. And my proof to that would be something like Acts 17:28. In him, we live, move, and have our being. That's a level of intimate care and interiority of care that goes right down to the existential level. Our very ising, so to speak, is actually in his hands and perfectly cared for by him. A couple of verses earlier, Paul says that he gives to all life, breath, and all things. That is a level of care and provision that is frankly incalculable to me as a human. So the scripture witnesses to a perfect, comprehensive, and intimate care of God for the creature. And I want to propose that that's precisely why he does not need to have experiences of the creature to stir up a care in him that previously was lacking. That's what I need. I need to be made to care. And so the experiences that I have make me care. You can make me care by stomping on my toe. You'll get my attention, and you'll even produce certain passions in me, pain and anger and moral disappointment. And these may all be states of mind or feeling or judgment that I wasn't in prior to you stomping on my toe. But your toe has, as it were, stirred up my care, even if it's the bad kind of care, which now I'm angry at you. The same thing is true when someone's plight stirs up our bowels of compassion and we desire to relieve their suffering. But there are people who deserve my care and compassion, about whom I currently don't care and I'm not compassionate about because I don't even know about their plight. And so I would need to have some kind of experience by which empathy, kind of getting in tune, so to speak, with their condition was something that I experienced by their action upon me. That could be, you know, pictures in a relief aid brochure, or that could be somebody telling me about someone's plight or looking at it with my own eyes. But all of these experiences actualize care for others inside of me. And that's important. We can't undermine the value of empathy and experience and of being brought into the condition of the other in order to care for them. What I'm proposing, though, is that if God is the one from whom, through whom, and to whom are all things, if he gives to all life, breath, and all things, and if in him we live, move, and have our being, then there's no sense in which God needs to be moved from a state of not caring to caring. That is to say, an experience, so to speak, of the world or of his creatures would in no way produce in him a more intense or actualized state of caring. And that's actually what that's actually what the doctrine is concerned to protect. That it's because he cares so perfectly that he does not require an experience to stir up that concern within him.
Yeah, very good. I think one of the problems here is our tendency to anthropomorphize God when we think about him. We habitually think about God in our own image, you know, and in some ways this is very natural. The Bible, like you said, the Bible sometimes depicts God, and very often actually in the Old Testament depicts God in anthropomorphic terms. So sometimes I think God is like us, except writ large in the heavens and stripped of all limitations. But when we think about God like this, James, we tend to import to God a human nature and then judge God as if he were a person like us. So when it comes to emotions and passions, the lack of passions is a privation in human beings. Right? Passions are proper to the kind of things that we are. And right. if we meet a fellow human being who lacks emotions, who lacks passions, we look at that person as if they're deficient, right? They're a deficient example of the species. So if we begin with the assumption that God is a person like us, then divine impassibility is going to look like a privation in God, right? It's going to look like a lack of a perfection. An impassible God will seem to be less perfect than we are, since he'll lack something that's essential to being a person, emotions, feelings, affections, and so forth. So such a God in our own image would appear to be distant and cold and uncaring and unempathetic. So although impassibility in humans is characterized as an imperfection, what you're saying is that impassibility in God is a feature of his perfection. So when we say that God is impassible, we're not saying something that makes him less than human. We're saying something that makes him more than human. God's experience is not lesser than human experience. When we say God's impassible, we're saying that God's experience is greater than human experience. And I like an example that Edward Fazer gives. He uses this example of reasoning, right? To say that God's life is qualitatively inferior to human life because he lacks passions is like saying that God's knowledge is qualitatively inferior to human knowledge because he lacks reasoning. Unlike humans, God doesn't engage in discursive reasoning where he's moving from something that he knows to some further knowledge implicit in what he knows by means of argument. Rather, God knows everything all at once in a simple and perfect act of understanding. But this doesn't make God's knowledge inferior to human knowledge. It makes it superior to it. So I don't know what you think about that, James, but I just think we have a tendency to anthropomorphize God. And if God is made in our image, then an impassible God definitely looks like something bad. Something
looks like a broken human.
It looks like a broken human. That's a really good way to put it.
And I think that, and if a human were unfeeling, then we would rightly conclude that there was something defective because humans are naturally passible. That is to, and
that's right.
Maybe we should step back and define our terms a little bit at this point. The word passion, our modern word emotion, is of recent vintage, so I'll stick with the older language, though at the transition point between passions and emotions, in my reading, most theologians tended to equate them conceptually, so I'm happy to just use them interchangeably. But a passion literally means that which is undergone or experienced. Passio is one of the nine accidents of being that Aristotle mentions in his categories. It's an undergoing. It's a happening to. It's something that is received in a patient. A patient is an undergoer. That's really what patient means, patiens. And so the undergoer receives a state of actuality from an agent. The agent is the actor, the one who actualizes the potential in something. And so you go to the doctor's office and you're the patient because you're there to undergo the operation of the agent or the physician who's supposed to produce a form of health in you through his agency. And so the patient is what receives the agency of another, and that agency actualizes potential in the patient. And the actualized potential we call a passion. It is a real state of being, but it is always a state of being caused by another, or an actualized state of being. It's a state of being that requires, so to speak, a maker or a cause. And if we kind of step back into why would Christians want to deny that of God, it is because of the biblical doctrine, and also I think the natural theological doctrine or conclusion that the first cause of all things is self-sufficient in himself. If he weren't, that is to say, if he were dependent upon causes, whether external, internal, more fundamental than himself, he would not be the first cause of all that comes to be. To put it simply in Bible language, he could just simply could not be the one from whom, through whom, and to whom are all things, as Paul says in Romans 11:36. He couldn't be the one upon whom all things depend, because there'd be something not himself, either in him or outside of him, producing his actuality of being. And Christians don't worship a God that is produced. We worship a God that produces. We worship a God who makes. Thomas Aquinas says that God is pure agent. That is to say, he's the giver of being, life, breath, and all things. He's not the receiver of it. But if God were to undergo passion, he would be receiving a state of being or actuality from whatever reduced his potentiality to act. And then he would simply not be the first cause of being for several reasons. That external agent would be his cause to just that extent that it produced passion in him. Moreover, there'd have to be principles in God really distinct from God, the principles by which he was actual, but then also the principles of potentiality, which in a little metaphysical speak would have to be really distinct from the principles of actuality, those being fundamentally irreducible, in which case then God would be reducible to a bundle of principles. Principles of act, principles of potentiality or potency. But none of those then would be God. God would be dependent upon a series of principles, act and passive potency, more fundamental than himself, and those principles would function as causes of his being, and then God, as God, would not be the first cause of all things. And whether you're doing a kind of cosmological argument, Aquinas style, or whether you're just reading Holy Scripture, in the beginning God, and all things are from God, and that God does not receive from human hands, he's not served by human hands, Acts 17:25. If you're just reading Scripture and believing it, kind of on face value, one of the necessary implications will be that God is purely actual, that God is not composed of parts, and entailed in that, that God is not subject to passions, passions being caused states of being.
Yeah, well put. So what's at stake here at the end of the day really is divine ultimacy. Because if you have a passible God, if you have a God that can be affected, that has to be moved from potency to act, then he can't be the ultimate reality. He can't be the ultimate explanation.
And I think this puts the Bible-believing Christian in a peculiar place, in as much as it's a question at a certain point, one set of text or another are going to have to be, and I try to say this carefully, deflated, not in the sense of truthfulness, but in the sense of literalness.
That's right.
One is going to have to be taken in a non-strictly literal fashion. So if God is the absolute first cause of all things, which Scripture stipulates explicitly in numerous places, then a necessary implication of that is that he cannot be reduced to principles more fundamental than himself. Otherwise, he just wouldn't be the first cause of all things. Yep. So that's one side of it. The other side is God was grieved in his heart. God changed his mind. God's bowels were turned over within him. God was appeased by the smelling of an aroma. Those sets of texts, I would propose, can be taken in a truthful way, non-literally. Mm-hmm. But if we try to take the text about God's absolute primacy of being and primal causality in a non-literal way, we'll be left without a reason for the world. We'll be left without an absolute self-sufficient creator. And so I propose that the texts that describe God as the absolute primal cause should be taken literally, and all texts indicating that he's subject to some cause of his being can be understood truthfully, but in a non-literal fashion.
And this isn't just a challenge for classical theists who want to uphold divine impassibility. I mean, even open theists take some texts as priority over others. You know, even people who deny God's impassibility or divine simplicity, for example, still deny that God has legs, right? Still deny that he is located physically in a space. You know, even people who are not classical theists have to bring some kind of an interpretive framework to the text of Scripture, right? It's not just the classical theist that has to do it. So, and the question is, what is going to inform that interpretive framework? Obviously, it can't just be Scripture itself, because it's the Bible that contains these anthropomorphic depictions and also these lofty theological statements. So where are we going to find the principle for interpretation? Where are we going to find that? Well, I think classically, Christians had said, well, we get this principle from the other book of God's divine revelation, the book of nature, right? And we can see through the use of natural human reason, reflecting on the natural world, that if God is going to be the ultimate reality, if he's going to be the first cause, if he's going to be the transcendent creator, then there are certain truths that must be the case. There are certain attributes that God must have if he's going to qualify as you've been saying, the first cause and the ultimate reality. So I just want to say, it's not just classical theists that have to apply some kind of interpretive framework to Scripture.
There's an interesting passage in Acts 14 where Paul and Barnabas are in Lystra. And there's a temple to Zeus just outside the city, and the people begin to identify them as Zeus and Hermes, and they want to bring and offer sacrifices to the apostles. And the apostles oppose this worship being wrongly identified as Olympian gods come down among the people. And they rush out among the people, and it says that they tear their robes. And they cry out, and this is, I'll harken back to the King James here, because I think the King James does a good job with this. And they say, men, why do ye these things? We are men of like passions with you, and we proclaim the gospel that you should turn from these vain things to the true and living God who made heaven and earth and all things therein. And it's a really interesting passage. The word "we are men of like passions" is homoepathes. We are men of passions like you are, or of like passions with you. And it's an interesting, most modern translations say, men, we're of the same nature as you. Although the text doesn't say of the same nature. It does actually say homoepathes. It doesn't say phusis. And so it's one of the two texts in the Bible, the other one being James 5, that uses this word of Elijah, who was a man of like passions with us. And it's actually in a context of Elijah suffering. So it actually works really well. And their argument is not simply, hey, we're not Olympians, you're making a mistake. Their argument is actually something more profound than that. The argument is that you should not worship beings which, like you, are subject to passions. And that this is actually one text in the Scriptures where we're told very clearly that the worship of passible beings is, in fact, a false worship. And so the reason we know is because they then say, we proclaim the gospel that you should turn from these vain things. But the vain thing in the context is not mistaking men for Olympians. I think the vain thing in the context is worshiping passible beings, which, of course, just, you know, remembering your first year of college in which you had to read all those Greek myths, the Greek gods and the Olympians were very passable gods. They were gods that were very easily moved emotionally by other gods and by humans and by their circumstances. They were anything but passionless.
That's right.
And so his argument is, you don't worship those because why wouldn't you worship the Olympians beside the fact that they're mythologies? Because they can't be the ones upon whom all things depend.
Mm-hmm.
Being subject to passions, they themselves depend upon others for states of actuality and being. And so I think that second half of the verse when the apostles say, we preach that the gospel that you should turn from these vain things, which I take in the context to be the worship of things homoepathes or subject to passions like you are. Turn from the vain things to the one who made heaven and earth and all that is therein. And actually what they're juxtaposing in those, if you translate homoepathes as passions, then you can actually see the juxtaposition. Don't worship being subject to passions, or we could translate that, don't worship patience. Rather, worship the universal agent. Don't worship ones to whom being is given. Rather, worship the one who gives being to all. And so he's juxtaposing the false gods of the Greeks, passible deities, with the God that they should worship, pure agent. And I think Aquinas is right in understanding it that way. But that's also the text that in the 17th century, all those Reformed Protestants were sort of proposing as a proof text for God without passions, is that statement by the apostles in Acts 14:17.
And it reminds me of later when Paul's in Athens and he's saying, look, guys, God can't be a being who dwells in temples, right? Because in him we live and move and have our being, right? He can't just be another being because he's the source of being. I think that's something that Paul reiterates there in Athens. So
just a couple chapters later, same kind of context, dealing with Greek religion, and he's walked around Athens and he sees all these temples made to false gods, and then he proclaims the God who made all things. And then he even says there, he's not served by human hands as though he needed anything. And I think Paul's point about service with human hands is he uses the word therapeuo. God doesn't undergo your therapeutic efforts. Put a little differently, God's not your patient.
Yeah,
he's your agent.
That's right.
He's the one who does for you and to you. He's not the one who's done to or unto by you. This often comes out when Paul's conflicting or contrasting the biblical God, the God of all creation, with the God of Greek religion.
Yeah, that's great. Well, in the time remaining that we have, let's turn to some of the major criticisms of the doctrine. In your article, Defending Divine Impassibility, in the book, I can't remember what it's called, Classical Theism's
Classical essays. Theism, New Essays on the Metaphysics of God.
Yes. So you have a chapter in there, Defending Divine Impassibility. There you take up what is perhaps the preeminent objection to God's impassibility from contemporary critics of the doctrine. It's an objection you call the passibilist critique from knowledge. So could you explain the objection for us and then your response to it?
Yeah, the objection is basically that if we believe God is omniscient, taking that as a premise, as a given, then would not impassibility lock him out of certain kinds of knowledge that would be required for omniscience? And in particular, the kind of knowledge that we acquire via experience, first-person experiential knowledge, which in the literature is a quale or qualia in the plural. And qualia are those things you know that we might describe as what it's like. And so let's just say, stubbing your toe on the door jamb. There's something that is like. Could an angel, which doesn't have toes, possibly understand what it's like to stub his toe? You might be able to describe it to him propositionally, and he might be able to theoretically try to simulate what it's like, but he couldn't really know what it's like to stub his toe or hit his thumb with a hammer. Or have any experiences that require a body, given that he doesn't have one. And so the qualia, the notion of qualia is the idea that there are certain bits of knowledge for which experience alone, undergoing, that is what I mean by experience, undergoing some happening to, is necessary for acquiring at least that particular bit of knowledge. And then if we're going to have knowledge of what it's like for others, and for in this case, if God is going to know what it's like for you to stub your toe or to, you know, or to fall in love or something like this, he's going to have to acquire that knowledge from you, either by having an experience of the exact same sort and thereby sort of having his own version of that qualia, or he's going to have to somehow derive from you the knowledge of that experience. So for instance, what it's like to be a sinner, or what it feels like to, you know, be guilty of sin, is not something that we would ever say God could have a first person experience of, he being entirely holy and perfect and righteous altogether. Nevertheless, if he's going to know what it's like for Anthony or James to be sinners, he's going to have to then acquire that knowledge from us who have, in one respect, a more privileged access to it than he does. He's going to have to simulate or receive a copy of that knowledge, and he's going to have to get the copy from us, the sinner, or from us, the experiencer. And so the argument is effectively that if God isn't passable, that is to say, if God can't have experiences, and if he can't derive states of being or actuality from the creature, then there are certain knowable things, the so-called what it's like, first-person experiential knowledge, that he'll never be able to know, in which case then we will have to forfeit omniscience. And so really what this argument is doing is it's playing off omniscience against impassibility, and it's trying to force a choice between the two and saying you can take impassibility and have God somewhat ignorant, or you can accept impassibility, and then at least you'll have the mechanism for omniscience. I guess that's the gist of the argument from knowledge.
So the argument is that a passable God is said to know more than an impassible God.
Yeah, R.T. Mullins will say that an impassible God has, or a passable God has more knowledge than an impassible God, because he at least has the ability to derive that knowledge from that creaturely privileged viewpoint, or maybe even gain that knowledge for himself in the ways that he might morally be able to.
Yeah, because he has that first person experiential knowledge.
There's a professor at the University of Oklahoma, Linda Zabzebski, who mm-hmm. has proposed famously in recent years a doctrine that she calls omnisubjectivity. And she proposes this as a divine attribute that has been missed in the history of the Christian church. And omnisubjectivity is really what she says, God's attribute basically of being able to feel or to derive at least simulated copies of feelings from creatures, basically empathy. And you can even hear the root of passions, pathos, pasco. These are the Greek words for passions. And empathy really is a state of feeling you enter into by, as it were, experiencing what another experiences, or at least getting a simulated copy of that experience somehow. And she wants to propose that for God to really care about us, he needs to have empathic experiences by which he gains from us that privileged viewpoint, enabling him to both know perfectly and thereby care better for us. And this is the caring part is actually something that Mullins develops. And his argument is that if we are not moved emotionally by horrendous events, that then there's something actually morally depraved in us. And I think if we're talking about humans, he's certainly correct about that. And so I think by, in a certain sense, expecting that to be the one mode by which we come to care about things, by taking that for granted, Mullins is able to actually make a very successful, albeit I think misguided, argument that if God is not moved, actually literally moved interiorly by horrendous events, then God's not so great. God is morally defective somehow. Anyone who's not moved by horrendous events is someone who isn't just ignorant or lacking knowledge. They're also lacking the knowledge that is requisite for morally caring about, that is to say, loving or opposing what is unlovely. And so that's another side of this. It's not just an argument from knowledge. It's an argument from knowledge with moral implications.
Yeah, and on the face of it, it sounds really appealing. So, James, how do we respond to this?
I think the first thing, in my response, I make a few critiques of the critique. The first one is just simply that it begs the question. And it does so this way, by taking it for granted that there's no other way for God to know human qualia except by receiving that knowledge from the creature. That's just being taken for granted. And I think what I would want to propose is that there may be, in fact, there is, a way of knowing qualia, that is to say, knowing our experiences without having to undergo experiences, that is, in fact, available to God. And I'll get to that in a second. So questioning that, Aquinas says that knowledge is in any knower according to the mode of the knower. And so the way that I know is very much conditioned by my nature. And of course, my nature is not just immaterial, it's also material and sensible. My knowledge, in fact, is not purely intellectual. My knowledge is also comprised of sense knowledge as well. So I have both intellectual knowledge and sense knowledge. And it is in my sense knowledge that I have those often first-person experiences, the what it's like, the stubbing of the toe, or even the physiological dynamics of falling in love, where you can feel a sort of physiological register of that emotional attraction to someone. So there's a sense in which my sensible self is in fact a necessary part of my overall knowing. And my intellectual knowledge, in a certain sense, derives its material from my sense knowledge. And I'm able to abstract from my sense knowledge, like, say, of a tree, the abstract notion of tree-ness itself. And I can even distinguish in my mind between the form and the matter of the tree. And I can even abstractly consider tree-ness distinct from any particular tree. Well, all that's going on in my intellect, but it's happening abstractly as I'm sort of moving from sense experiences and then having received those sense experiences, abstracting intellectually universal forms, for instance. But that process of knowing, by which I abstract from sense experiences the nonsensible forms that underlie and account for those sense experiences, the reason that I know that way or come to understand things that way is because of the kind of being I am. Because I'm not just a mind, I'm a mind situated in a body that needs to negotiate with sensible ways of knowing in order to arrive at intellectual ways of knowing. All right, so that's Aquinas' basic argument. But there's no good reason then to say that immaterial creatures like angels or disembodied human souls in the intermediate state or God necessarily need to arrive at knowledge by that same route.
Yeah.
Meaning, given that they don't have a sensible or sensual component in the mix knowing, in the mix of knowledge, their way of knowing would not necessarily be reducible to that mode. And so I think that's the first critique we need to make of this argument from knowledge. It goes back to the point we're making a few minutes ago, that human ways of knowing are not necessarily the only or the ultimate ways of knowing. And to propose that certain privileged access that is required for humans is actually required for even non-human knowers like angels and God, that's actually what's begging the question. That's what I think the critics do not demonstrate in their argument.
Great. So it begs the question, but the question remains, how should we understand how it is that God knows the first person experiences of his creatures?
Yeah, and so far we want to say, not by deriving it from the creatures, not by observation. I think of a text like Isaiah 40, verses 12 to 14, that asks the question, who has informed God, or who is his counselor, has taught him in the way of knowledge? Or I think of a text like Psalm 94, where it says that God formed the eye and he formed the ear. Does he not see? Does he not hear? Even God who teaches all men knowledge. And so even there, the source of our knowledge is actually God himself, so that we are not the source of God's knowledge. God is the source of our knowledge. So these texts in scripture that indicate a primacy of knowledge, in which God's knowledge is not gotten from the creature, but is actually what informs and illumines the creature, is the direction we should go. Now, I think you could also get there through a cosmological argument as well, that the maker of all things, the first cause of all things, is in fact an intelligent maker, not just a source, like Plotinus's one or something like that. So what we should say instead is that God knows all things causally. And I want to propose causal knowledge, and this is not original with me. There are several writers in recent years. Blankenhorn is one who has proposed this in objection to Zebrzebski's notion of omnisubjectivity. So certainly this is not a discovery of mine. But that causal knowledge is saying that God knows all things in the creature, not just that they are, but even their experiences, because in some fundamental sense, he is the ultimate cause of those things. So let me step back from that. We're kind of returning to the primal causality notion that really undergirds classical theism generally, and wanting to say that if a thing is known best when it's known in its causes, and I'm riffing off Aristotle a little bit here, a thing is known best when it's known in its causes. And if God is the first and complete cause of all creatures, or everything not God, then we should say that everything that God makes, God knows from a privileged perspective of making it so. And so that his light is actually what illumines our knowledge. So let's just come to the question of our first-person perspective, our experiential knowledge. Causal knowledge would be something that is neither properly experiential, because God doesn't derive it through an experience he undergoes, nor is it merely propositional. That is to say, it's not merely theoretical, the way that I might be able to say theoretically and in some limited and incomplete way understand the life of an angel, for instance, which is very much unlike my own. Modes of locomotion would be different. I would never have a first-person experience of immaterial local motion. Modes of knowing, which don't extract, you know, universals from sense experience particulars. I could theoretically write a kind of speculative angelology in which I could say what I believe are many true things about the way angels move and the way angels know, and maybe even propose ab eternity and conjecture about the way they relate to time differently than we do. And I think all of that could be done, not proposing that I comprehend that, but I do think I could know it truly to some extent. But that would be propositional knowledge extrapolated from things revealed to me that was then theoretical or propositional in character, not experiential in character. I wouldn't have first-person experiences, thereby giving me insider knowledge about what it's like to be an angel. And those two ways of knowing, propositional, theoretical, or experiential, I want to propose are not the only two ways of knowing. That causal knowledge is actually something that transcends both of those things and is actually deeper than both of those things. So when it comes to our experiences, for instance, the happenings too that give us that first person experiential knowledge, that if all things are from him, through him, and to him, if in him we live, move, and have our being, then our own being, our own movements, or our experiences, our undergoings, and even the actuality of our knowledge derived from those experiences are all from God as the first one and the sustainer of all things.
Yeah.
So God has a privileged access to my experiential knowledge, Anthony, that I want to propose is even deeper and more interior than my own experiential knowledge of myself. One of the authors that I quote in the book, Marcel Sauraud, says that there's a certain privileged knowledge that we have that is even deeper in us than what God could know. And yet I think of a text like 1 John that says God is greater than our heart and knows all things, that God actually knows my experiential knowledge more intimately and perfectly than I do. And not because he knows it propositionally or in a merely theoretical way, but because he's actually causing that experiential knowledge to be in me. He's not just causing That's my right. experiences. He's also causing the actuality of my knowledge of the experiences. And again, if God is the ultimate and complete first cause of all things, including my experiential knowledge or qualia, then God knows qualia better than the one who's experiencing it. Like, God That's knows right. my experiences better than I do as the experiencer, because his knowledge as causal is more interior to my experiences, not less interior. And I even at the close of the chapter, I try to make the argument that this, in fact, enables the God of classical theism to have a knowledge of our experiences, not that is remote from our experiences, which is what the argument of the passibilist is, that he's lacking knowledge because he doesn't have experiences. I want to propose that this transcendence of all experience as the first cause and sustainer of all things privileges God's knowledge with a deeper interiority yeah. and intimacy, not less.
That's right.
That he knows me, he knows my experiences better, not worse, than if exactly. he'd had experiential knowledge.
I often like to say it's God's radical transcendence that makes possible God's radical immanence. Unless God were radically transcendent, he could not be radically intimate, right? Radically immanent to us. It's the very transcendence of his being that allows him to be as close to a being as is possible. And as Aquinas says, you can't get closer to a being than causing that being to be. Like, that's the most intimate, the closest that you can get. And as pure act, God is the cause of all the actuality outside of himself. That includes, yes, the existence of a creature like you and me, but it also includes all of our experiences, right? It includes our cognition, our cognitional life. Everything that is actual in us, God is right now causing to be in us. And again, as Aquinas points out, it doesn't get more intimate than that, right? It doesn't get more intimate than that. So
God knows my experiences better than I do from my privileged first person perspective, because he's making the experiences to be or to occur, and he's making my knowledge of them to be, and he's greater than my heart. He knows my experiences better than my own experiencing of them gives me knowledge. And I think this is the important point. And you make a nice distinction, I think, without a separation between transcendence and immanence, that the interiority and the immanence of God is not something that corrects his aloofness.
Yeah.
That it's because of his transcendence that he doesn't require a series of mediating experiences to draw near to us. Whereas you and I, if I'm going to get to know you, I'm going to have to receive some knowledge from you. You're going to have to say some things to me. You're going to have to show me some things. You're going to have to, as it were, bring me in, because I'm not there in terms of my knowledge of you. But no experience that God undergoes of the world, which I'm denying he has anyway, brings him into the world. There's no world without God in it with the fullness of his being making it to be. And
that's right.
That causality and that causal knowledge gives God a privileged access to our experiences that is even more intimate than the experiencing knowledge itself. And I think if we can say that, then at least this doesn't mean that there aren't a whole raft of other arguments against impassibility that need to be considered and answered. But I think this argument that without qualia, without undergoing an experience by which God derives knowledge from us, he's somehow lacking knowledge of us, is really missing the point that he's the one from whom, through whom, and to whom are all things. And if a thing is known best and it's known in its causes, then no one knows better than God.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, very good. Is there anything else here, James, that you think needs to be said in this context before we wrap it up?
I think in this for this episode, I think this is a good statement of at least the alternative to the challenge from knowledge regarding impassibility. But again, I think maybe a way, a note to send it off on, is just simply to say, because of this perfect, complete interiority of God's knowledge, the question of whether an impassible God really cares should now be rendered moot. He couldn't possibly care more. He's the reason you are.
That's exactly right. Well, James, this has been a fantastic discussion. Thanks for this.
Thanks, Anthony.